Accession number 26562, Mr. Ken Taylor, reel number 10. We were talking about your time aboard HMS Gore and talking about a sort of typical anti-submarine patrol.
Yeah.
One thing you've been wanting to talk about, I think, is how they rolled, especially in comparison perhaps to the Formidable. Were they unusual in the way they rolled, the Captain Class and the Gore in particular? Can you talk a bit about what they were like in rough weather or any weather?
Oh, I mean, they seem to heel over. On the bridge, you've always got a... I can't think of the word. Inclimeter or something. Tell you the angle of the roll, and I often heard the officers remark, and you know that was a sort of 30 degrees or something. I mean, it's quite remarkable because of the design, and you know, a lot more up top than down below, shall we say? But
it's a different. You,
no. I found, funny enough. On the Formidable, going back, we had some sailors who were destroyer sailors, and they were old sailors, had been used to destroyers. When they went aboard the Formidable, they were seasick. They hadn't been seasick before because it was a long loping sort of roll, completely different. But I was never seasick on any ship I was on.
So for you, it was just a different sort of movement?
Just movement.
It didn't bother you?
No, I always felt, my view on that was you pay a lot of money on a fairground to get a feeling like this.
Now, what about they were made of... They were all welded, yeah, as opposed to rivets.
Yeah.
Yeah. Again, you've been on a big ship, a Royal Navy ship, yeah, rather than an American ship, yeah, really. Did you have any opinion about that, good or bad, welded ships? Because some people I know, especially old sailors, worried about the welds. Yeah. What did you think of them?
Well, it didn't particularly worry me. I mean, the reason being, they were built in 48 hours. I mean, they were in units. I mean, around the country, I don't know how they were split up, but... The ship was built in sections and they were all put together in 48 hours. The thing that took the time, I mean, I wasn't in Boston when she was commissioned, but they said it took about a month to ammunition and provision her. And it took 48 hours to build her, you know, sort of get all the stuff on board, you know, with all the equipment and everything else. So, and they were a very, very good thing.
And it didn't worry you? You weren't worried the ship would break apart?
No.
What about the American Star facilities? I mean, you joined her late, so had they all gone? Things like the water fountains, the you know, that sort of thing.
Oh yeah. Well, I mean, what happened was as I understand it, the Royal Navy. The reason we called them Captain Class frigates, well, they were named because they were named after old naval captains, but we couldn't call them destroyer escorts as they were, because the Navy's requirement was they had the torpedo tube removed. And extra depth charges put on, so they couldn't be classed as a destroyer. That's why they classed them as frigates. And I think they had something like 190 depth charges on, which was a lot of depth charges. And because they also had that modern weapon, as it was then, the Hedgehog, with the forward-firing pattern of bombs that detonate on contact. I remember one of the captain-class frigate... association meetings, reunions, the Americans were asked about the destroyer escorts and their torpedoes. Did they ever fire any of the destroyers ever fire torpedoes? And the Americans said only one fired torpedoes out of, I think there were 600 built altogether, including the ones we had. Only one ever fired torpedoes, and that was at the Battle of Leyte, and it missed. That was America's answer. So, I think the Admiralty did a wise thing in sort of making them as anti-submarine, purely and simply.
But what about the... I mean, when I meant that some of the Americans... They had a lot of luxury things on board when they were first built, and then the Royal Navy ripped them out. I was wondering if any were left in when you...
No, there was nothing sort of like that. We had the normal eating on the mess deck, general messing. We didn't have water fountains or coffee machines or anything like that.
What about the laundry?
No laundry, no. You did your own laundry.
the Royal Navy,
Naval ship, yeah.
Now, what about the nature? I mean, what was a typical anti-submarine patrol like? I mean, how much action would you see generally? What would happen?
Oh, sometimes, I mean, it'd be 28 days at sea and nothing. You might get a... You might get an ASDIC ping, nothing come of it. You know, it's another time you go out and you completely active. I mean,
and what was it like when you got a contact with a submarine? What was the procedure as far as the ship was concerned, and you in your
you'd
be pretty peripheral to it.
Yeah. Well, the leader would nominate say a couple of ships. I can't remember the term now, but basically to patrol around the area as like a guard, really, you know, sort of while the others were attacking. Depending on what was happening, the way they attacked, sort of one or two would attack with hedgehogs or depth charges. When it got severe, we used to do what they called a creeper attack. And this used to was very, very effective, but caused a lot of damage to our own ships. What used to happen was, if you got a very skillful U-boat commander, as soon as you fired your first depth charges, they would hear the click of the depth charges going, and he would do a 90-degree turn to left or right. Well, once the depth charges started going off, the ASDIC operator has to remove his headphones because it would blow his ears out. So you're dropping depth charges blind after that, and he could be steering the other way. So if you've got a very expert man, and I'm not an anti-submarine warfare man, but what used to happen was the leader would sit back a certain distance from the U-boat. He would have the U-boat on his ASDICs pinging him, and he would send three ships in, line abreast, going very, very slowly so that the screws were just hardly ticking over. He would have his radar on the centre ship, his sonar on the U-boat, and as soon as they were over, they used to drop 28 charges each. And they were going off underneath you. So you had stanchions buckling, seams breaking and leaking, and all hell was let loose. And underneath our deck, there was diesel oil. And sometimes the seams broke in the deck, so you had diesel coming through. And because your lockers was underneath the bottom bunk, so sometimes your clothes got soaked in diesel oil, and it left a terrible smell. You didn't do those creep attacks all that often, but when you did, I mean, you know, we had some German survivors of a U-boat we'd sunk on board on one trip, and as they said, they wouldn't fight against their own country, but they were very proud men. They would earn their own keep, and they used to go up to the galley and get the food and serve it. They'd scrub the mess deck, clean up, and when we did creeper attacks, their expertise in shoring up, you know, the leakages in the ship, you know, that's all they were absolutely experts. They used to it in U-boats, and you know, they wouldn't fight their own people, but they were quite prepared to help us, you know, in a non-belligerent way, sort of thing. And the amazing thing is, you used to have a seaman on the mess deck where they would kept, you know, as prison. They were living with the sailors as prison. And in those days, Commander in Chief Western Approaches said every sailor should carry a large knife. So we all had sheath knife. In fact, I had an American Marine's dagger type knife, which I'd got off someone somewhere. I can't remember where I got it. And the idea being that you could cut yourself away from wreckage or, you know, sort of ropes and that sort of thing. And this German wanted to make a model, and there's a sailor down there with a gun, you know, sort of supposed to be guarding him. He said, "Can I borrow your knife?" And Jack gives him his whacking great dagger. He's carving this sort of bit of wood with it. They were all right. One of the funny things was they, with their propaganda, their attitude was, we're all sailors and the brotherhood of the sea, and they were quite happy on ship. When they knew they were being landed ashore, they were terrified. Their propaganda told them they were going to be executed, all sorts of things, you see. And we took them into Gibraltar. And the British Army came aboard to escort them ashore. Of course, they were all blindfolded and they were all in a line, and they had one hand on the shoulder of the man in front, guide him down the gangway. Well, evidently, one of our sailors, while they were at sea, had taught them to hold their nose with their left hand, pull their right hand down, as if pulling the chain, and say, "Hitler, pour us piss. Churchill, pour us piss." And as these blokes are going down the gangway, one of them stumbled. He went, "Churchill, pour us piss." And these soldiers looked absolutely terrified. A sailor's sense of humour.
So, now, Do you remember these incidents when the U-boats were sunk, or the dates?
Can't remember the dates. In the book, but I can't remember the dates.
Do you remember what happened, though? I mean, are they separate in your mind, or...? Not you wouldn't be watching, would you? You'd be in the wireless. So.
Well, one of them surfaced and started to open fire, and I nipped up. The wireless source was up just under the bridge, and I nipped up to the side where the searchlight had searchlight on each side, and the U-boat started to fire because our gunners opened fire. And I just got on the searchlight, switched it on, and shone it on. You know, there was other lights on, the signal lights, everything else on it. But I put the searchlight on for a while, on the 20-inch signal lantern. We called it a searchlight, one of the searchlights, a signal lantern. But it's a dangerous thing to do, really, because they're going to fire at it. You don't think of these things when you're young, do you? But
and did you see a beast sunk, or what happened?
Well, they jumped overboard, and we picked up the survivors. The captain of the U-boat shared the captain's cabin. And the sailors on the deck, and the other officers. I think we had about 15 of them. I can't remember how many was altogether. Somewhere on the other ship.
These are the prisoners you were.
The prisoners,
about.
Yeah, yeah.
And did you see? I mean, she sank from the shells, or did she sink from the effects of depth charge? What had made her surface? You know.
Well, she surfaced because she was forced up, and then obviously as soon as she surfaced, she started the fire. But when we opened fire, they all abandoned the ship. So I expect.
Is
she...
this the one that Mike Darcy wrote the article about? Or is that the other one?
No, I'm not sure. The other one. The other one, the long one. I think that was the one that surfaced and. Fired a torpedo and sunk one of our ships, and then we went in again after him.
Do you remember that? Do you remember
no.
what happened there?
That's, no.
You don't remember that
no,
one?
No, no, no.
Were you in, you'd be in Europe, you didn't
got,
see that?
I got a feeling that was the one where I was ashore doing my PO's course and exam.
So you missed that
I
one?
I missed that one, yeah.
Now we mentioned Mike Darcy, but I mean, we've interviewed him, as you know.
Yeah.
Nice chap. Can you tell us what was he like at the time? Because we've seen him now, but what was he like as a young, sub-lieutenant?
Handsome young man, very dark. In fact, he and I gelled. I mean, you can't be, you know, buddy-buddies as a petty officer and an officer, but he was, apart from being the anti-submarine warfare officer, he was the confidential book officer. He was responsible... confidential books. The navigating officer was the signal officer, but he was so he used to have to come down and he used to come down and muster the books regularly at the appropriate times. But funny enough, I always seemed to gel with Mike Darcy.
Why do you think that was? Was it
just something about we're exactly the same. Well, I think he's 1 month older than me. We're virtually exactly the same age. In fact, he came ashore with us once, which doesn't matter about telling now because he's out of the Navy. Come ashore because. I was going out with a. Oh, I know that was after the European War ended. We paid off in West Hartlepool, and I met a girl there, and she invited us to this house, and there was some dads and girls. We're going to have a bit of a party, and Mike came with us. He always tells me he remembers that party, and I'd forgotten he was there in actual fact, but he came with us.
And that's pretty unusual for an officer to go end of the war or not.
Yeah.
Was he a sub-lieutenant or a lieutenant?
Sub-lieutenant then, yeah. And you got made lieutenant later.
And what, do you remember any of the other officers? The captain or the
first? I remember Captain Reeves Brown. Reeves Brown, I think his name was. Reeves hyphenated Brown. I think he was an ex-Merchant Navy officer who came to the Navy.
And what was he like? Is that, he'd be a lieutenant commander, would he?
No, he was a lieutenant, actually. He wasn't all that popular.
Now, why not?
I think it may be because he wasn't having that responsibility of command of a ship like that, and perhaps he hadn't had that before, and coming from the Merchant Navy, and I got a little, not when I was on the ship, but a little hint from Mike on the reunions, that I don't think he was popular with the officers. He could be a bit of a prig, really.
What about the Jimmy the One, the first lieutenant? Yeah. Or are they? Do you remember their names?
I can't remember their names. But, you know, I couldn't even. I said to Mike, I said, I always remembered your name because I said, funny enough, we all seemed to gel. We had a sort of something gel. I said, the signal officer was the one I should remember. I can't even remember his name. And he told me, and I've forgotten it again. He said, oh, he retired when he came out of the Navy when he was a bank manager. And he said, I've invited him to reunions. He hasn't come.
And was he a good officer?
Oh, yeah. He was a navigating officer, yeah. And because you're a signal officer as well. Because they rely on you. You're running the department, isn't it?
But he didn't get in your way.
Oh, no. He was all right. Reeves Brown, it's a bit of a prig. I mean, it was an unusual thing on those ships. On a Royal Naval ship, as I mentioned before with the Formidable, on each mess deck you have a speaker, but they have the entertainment thing in a separate office, like amplifiers, a receiver and record player. On these ships, they had a receiver in the radio office, which was specifically designed for the entertainment of the crew. And on each mess deck, not only was there a speaker, but within the speaker cabinet was an amplifier. So you just had this receiver in the office, and you had an amplifier and speaker on each mess deck to give them the correct sound. Now, after D-Day, the lads got... that's all run by what they call the canteen committee. Canteen committee, you know, gets some money from the profits of the canteen and spends on some goodies and that. And they pay someone to operate that. Sort of put on what they want. Because it was in the radio office, I insisted it had to be a communicator because no one else could come in the radio office. Which was a bit, I said, you know, you can vote for who you like, but it's got to be a communicator. The ship's company wanted the Armed Forces radio network on. And so we put that on. The captain sent for me one day and he said, fed up with this Armed Forces radio, he said, you will put it on BBC Radio 1 or whatever it was called. It wasn't called Radio 1 then, was it? It was called Home Service or something. So I said, I'm sorry, sir. I said, it's on that because, you know, the radio belongs to the ship's company and the ship's company wanted that. And he said, I'm giving you a direct order to put it on the Home Service. Direct order, got to obey. So I went down to the radio office, tuned it on to the Home Service, left it on for 15 minutes, switched the set off, took it out of its rack, put it on the workbench, took all the valves out, put a test meter on the bench, and waited for the captain. 10 minutes later, he came down. He said, I told you to put on the Home Service. I said, I did, sir. He said, yes. He said, but it went off. I said, it's broken down. And he looked at me much to say, liar. I looked at him much to say, I'm not. he went. I left it for about an hour, put the valves back in, put it back up on the Armed Forces network, and it stayed on. That was the sort of man he was. He could get up, you know, up your nose easy. We're taking the D-Day.
Now you were doing... You were doing these hunter-killer things up to D-Day.
About a week. We're back in harbour. We're back in Pollock Dock, and then we sailed from Pollock Dock. And funny thing was, D-Day was supposed to be so secret, but it was amazing. As the ships are steaming out of Pollock Dock, there's half the population of Belfast at the gates waving us goodbye. Quite funny, and they all knew something was, you know, going on different. We didn't go straight to D-Day because we, as an escort group, I expect the other ships went different places, we sailed to Moultrie Bay in Anglesey. And I always remember that. That was a very nice break because we anchored in Moultrie Bay in Anglesey and it was glorious weather. And we were given as much leave as possible where we just taken ashore to the little village there. By boat, but then you could walk round the corner and it was all rocky, beautiful clear water, and we used to swim off there, so it was very nice. It was like a relaxing week, and then we sailed from there for D-Day.
And what were you going to do at D-Day? What happened?
We were basically doing the same job with other, obviously, escort groups, trying to keep the channel clear for all the troops and going across. I mean, we weren't actually involved in any shelling of the beaches or, you know, landing of troops. We were sort of covering, you know, anti-submarine patrols, covering against attacks on the ships. Now, from that time onwards, we used a certain period at sea, and I can't remember how long now, and we used to go back into Plymouth for reprovisioning and re-ammunitioning. And then it was during this time that the Capel got sunk.
Now, what did anything happen? I mean, did you encounter any submarines in the channel? Or was it just basically...
Yeah, as I say, that's when the Capel got
sunk. That's the first time.
First time. I mean, we often got sonar contacts, but sometimes it turned out to be a wreck and that's on because there's lots of wrecks around and they had the chart. Sometimes nothing happened. But then the Capel got torpedoed.
Now, tell me exactly what you remember of that incident then.
It was just a bang and she went straight down, virtually, you know, bow down, virtually vertical, and the stern was just sticking out of the water. Ships immediately turned sort of in the direction they thought the torpedo would come from, but you know, you don't want to be broadside on. And the Afflick, which was the leader, she got the second torpedo, caught her in the stern. Exploded on the stern, and of course, on the stern, apart from depth charge, you had all these chemicals for smoke making. And what happened, this was blown right across the ship, and anybody on the deck, they all had terrible burns on their faces and heads and, you know, that sort of thing from these burns. That's all. While this was going on, we were pinging for the U-boat. And the thing with these Captain Class frigates, if they got hit forward, the hedgehog magazines and the hedgehogs used to seem to blow up, and everything forward of the funnel used to sort of blow up. It's happened to ships before. Well, the radio office was for... This is one reason why on my ship, a lot of the ships had radio communications mess deck forward. But on my ship, we had them aft, because I said, you know... the signal officer, you know, we all agreed that, you know, if anything happened, you lost the front end of the ship, and you still got some communicators out. And also from the morale point of view, if everybody's forward of the funnel, you know, they know, you know, the chances are going. This was quite a moment for me, because everything seems to go quiet, and I was in the radio office with the coder and an operator. One of the frequencies, which they call the convoy of distress frequencies, is usually on loudspeaker. On the MFDF set phone, if you usually have it on the loudspeaker and MFDF set as well. And I thought my lads were looking a bit shaky because they knew they were forward of the funnel. So I said, would you like to go after the funnel and have a smoke, you see, and I'll take over. So I sat in the office all on my own. Very, very quiet, because the speaker's on, all you could hear is bing, bing. And I didn't smoke cigarettes, but the chap left his cigarettes on the bench and I got through half his packet. Because it's so quiet, you know, all on my own. But then everything was all right, the lads come back, and it was quite sort of, you know, no action, no nothing, but just quiet, and you feel worse than if you're actually in action.
And it's particularly the forward section, because, and it was the hedgehog
magazine. I think it was mainly the hedgehog magazine, you know, sort of, they were sort of very, sort of touchy, I suppose.
And anything else, I mean, what happened over there, the Capel and the Afflick, anything, I mean, did you get rescue anyone, or the Afflick was towed home, wasn't it?
The Afflick was towed back, but, a Capel, she was down. I can't remember whether they picked up any survivors or not of that. One of the humorous things was that because I was a strong swimmer, this was all the time I was on the go, they had a couple of volunteers. The main idea being that if there were survivors to be picked up and they were exhausted, you would go over the side and pick them up. You know, the first lieutenant had a canvas harness made, and then, you know, a long rope on it. So you go to the side, you'd be on the rope, take another rope with you to the survivor and tie it round. Well, while we were sort of on these patrols in the channel, we saw this big bag with a metal top to it, sort of long top with a padlock on. There's air in the bag, so it's floating. It said United States Navy. We thought it was a confidential rucksack, you see, to come off a ship. So the first lieutenant sent for me, and he said, we're going to get that aboard. So I'll get in my swimming trunks and put the harness on over the side. It wasn't all that warm either. Went over the side, swam to this sack, tied this other rope around it. They hoisted aboard, and I thought, oh, saved a lot of confidential books, you know, so a hero. Get it on the deck. First lieutenant gets one of the sailor's knives, cuts it open, and all sorts of muck come out on the deck. It was ordinary United States Marlin. Mummy had sent cakes and chocolates and and this would have been the sea, and went all over the first lieutenant's upper deck, and he wasn't too pleased.
That was a false alarm. Did you ever have to go over the side to rescue
No,
people?
No, I didn't. Never happened. They put the scrambling nets down whenever the new boats sort of, we picked up survivors, and they just scrambled up the nets at the side if they got to it. Some of them, you'd see them die in the water with a cold as they were swimming towards you. But
while you're on this channel thing, did you see much of what was going on near the channel area? Were you much further away?
Much further down. The only thing you got was, which was a nightmare, was you'd be patrolling there in the channel in the middle of the night. And there's all these aircraft going across on their bombing raids. And they test their guns when they're over the sea. And all you got was cartridge cases coming down on the ships. I mean, it was dangerous, really. You're showering down. Everybody out there with their tin hat on. Because
this is British, you've
read. British, yeah. Just, before they hit the coast, they check the guns sort of thing. And of course, they've got the cartridges dropping down.
And anything else you remember about that period?
Yep.
So, you were based at Plymouth during that. What was Plymouth like as a base?
Oh, it was a good run ashore there. We used to use a pub called the Camel's Head round at St Budo. No longer exists. I went back there some time later and it's all gone, highway there. I always remember Blondie and my appetites there, because things were rationed. We used to go in there, we used to drink pints of mild beer, and they used to have this big meat platter piled high with usually either cheese and onion or cheese and tomato rolls. And we used to go in there and get a couple of pints, and we used to say, can we have some, cheese rolls? How many do you want? We say, we'll have that plate full. Look at that, 20 rolls on there. And I think we used to drink several pints of beer and eat all these rolls. The appetite of young men.
Was there a welcoming place for a sailor's Plymouth? I mean, it's an old naval's port, isn't it?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, it was very nice, yeah. Very busy, very nice, yeah.